Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz.
I'm Lav Harkov.
And we're talking to you just as Israel is in the middle of another round of violence with Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the Gaza Strip. Over 1,000 rockets have been raining down on Israeli cities over the last 36 to 48 hours. Israel has been striking back at Gaza. And last night, we're talking on Wednesday, May 12th. Last night, Lahav, you live in Tel Aviv. You had quite the eventful evening.
Yes, we started recording this podcast last night, and if you keep listening, you'll be able to hear live how it went. But we had to stop in the middle because I heard a siren outside, and I just had to go. I had to get off the Zoom. I had to grab my children from their bedroom. I had to frantically wave at my husband, who was on his own work Zoom and didn't hear the siren, and we each grabbed a kid. We ran into the basement of our building. Technically, our building doesn't have a shelter, but there's an apartment in the basement. So we know from the past that the people who live in that apartment let everyone in instead of us having to stand in the stairwell. My kids are small. I have an almost two-year-old, so he was just kind of sleepy and putting his head on me and didn't affect him that much. But my other kid is 4 years old, and she was like, "Why are we here? What is this? Why did you take me out of bed in the middle of the night?" And we kind of weren't really prepared, honestly, because the last time this happened was 2 years ago. And you know, it was actually, I was 9 months pregnant. And she didn't have as many questions. And the sad thing was that there were other kids who live in my building who were like in grade school, you know, ranging from, I think, like third to fifth, sixth grade. And they were terrified because they knew what was happening. And they were crying. They were saying, like, you know, is it going to hit us? Is it going to hurt us? So that was really heartbreaking. We were down there for about 40 minutes, I would say. And I was texting with the Jerusalem Post military correspondent, Anna Ehrenheim, who was, of course, sheltering in Rishon LeZion, which is a city close to Tel Aviv. And we only went upstairs when she said that she thought it was okay to go upstairs.
Anna gives the green light, but sadly in Rishon, there was, during that same barrage, there was one woman who was killed in one of those rocket attacks. So far, as we speak, 5 Israelis have been killed in rockets. You know, the day before, so on Monday, when this whole thing began, Monday was Jerusalem Day here in Jerusalem, where I live, and I'm at the office. It's around 6 o'clock at night, and suddenly sirens go off in Jerusalem. Now, we haven't had sirens in Jerusalem, I think, since 2014, since the big Gaza war, Operation Protective Edge. And we all move kind of to, we're on the sixth floor of a building, so we all move into the center of the floor, far away from the windows. And I call my wife and I say, "Where are you?" And she's, "Oh, we're out in the middle of a field playing flag football with one of the kids." And then I got another kid who's out bike riding with this bike riding group. So it's quickly, okay, how do we get everyone? How do we assemble and get them home? Some of my kids remember 2014, and this brought back those memories, which were definitely unpleasant. But you know, I always think about friends that I have who live down south. I was speaking with one friend who is a city council member in Ashkelon, which has really been hammered over the last couple of days with probably the bulk of these rockets. They haven't had one moment of quiet. And yes, Iron Dome has done a good job, but this is really, really, it takes a toll. It takes a toll on people's, you know, obviously the physical pain, but the mental suffering that people go through.
Yeah, I mean, it's very distressing. It's also, you know, Iron Dome, thank God we have Iron Dome, but it doesn't solve all the problems. For starters, you know, after the Iron Dome goes off and you usually hear the boom if you're nearby, you're supposed to wait 10 minutes before you leave shelter, at least 10 minutes, because all the pieces fall on the ground and they hurt people and they damage property, et cetera. So it's not as bad as an actual explosion, and thank God we have it, but it doesn't mean that nothing happens. And then, yeah, there's such a mental toll. I mean, there's so many children. You know, there's about 1 million people live in Israel South, and all those children are just traumatized. I mean, they have to live through their childhood. You know, right now everybody's focused and talking about it, but every few months there's something in the South. So the rockets barely stop there.
One of the things that's happening, and we're going to talk in a bit with Anna Ehrenheim, the Jerusalem Post military correspondent, kind of the military aspects of what's happening. And it seems to me, and we'll talk a little bit with Annie, of how Israel was caught a bit with its pants down, or, you know, a bit surprised by this whole situation. They had planned a big military drill. They suddenly canceled at the last second. This was supposed to be the biggest drill ever. It was on Jerusalem Day. Like, we weren't ready, it seemed to me. But I'm curious, Lahav, you're the diplomatic correspondent. You've spent a lot of time in the Knesset covering politics as well. We're in a mess, right? We got this escalation in Gaza. We have a prime minister who's interim. That's Benjamin Netanyahu. We have Yair Lapid, who has the mandate to form a coalition. This comes at a really weird time for Israel, no?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a leadership vacuum. I mean, yes, Netanyahu and Gantz are still in office. But it's in this political situation where it may or may not be the end of Netanyahu's career. You know, he just lost the mandate to form a government. And, you know, after 2 years of repeated elections, it just seems like the leadership has become very weak. All of their decisions are sort of looked at, you know, with suspicion. That being said, I think that most of the political spectrum, you know, from the moderate left all the way through the right, you know, are sort of united behind the fact that you know, Hamas is bad and we need to strike back at them. But it is a weird situation. And also politically, I mean, you know, people were talking about the possibility of a quote-unquote change coalition. That's like the term that Yair Lapid likes to use. You know, that Netanyahu wouldn't be prime minister anymore, and it would be ranging from Naftali Bennett and Gideon Saar on the right to Meretz and Labor on the left. And it would have outside support from Ra'am, which is the Islamist party in Israel, which, despite being an Islamist party, they've, for the past year or so, been more open to cooperation with the government, with who, you know, with Netanyahu or whoever's in charge on civic issues. But now they've pulled out and they're not negotiating with anyone. And I think that really underscores sort of the weakness of any coalition, whether it's right wing or whether it's the other sort of hodgepodge, very diverse coalition. They will be very weak if they have to rely on these parties that so strongly identify with the Palestinians that that anytime there's some sort of major security event, they're going to sort of run away. And I think that there's going to be a shift now in the way these negotiations go.
And they seem to be going quite well before all of this, right? So things, you know, there was a sense of optimism that maybe even within just a matter of days, they'd be able to form a coalition. But the other story I think that's happening right now, which is troubling, because when I think about Gaza, you know, ever since the disengagement, I remember being there back in 2005, and as Israel, the military was pulling people out of their homes, and there was a sense of, you know, people obviously were warning of the ramifications, but there was a sense of hope, and that's what definitely Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister at the time, was trying to push, if this could change the dynamic. It obviously didn't, and since then, we've only suffered more and more terrorism, but we've also found ourselves...
The one dynamic that has changed is there are fewer Israelis dying in and because of Gaza.
That's true. That is true. But we have these cycles of violence every few years.
Right. Right. So it has changed the dynamic. The question is, you know, it's definitely not the peace we were promised, though, or the quiet.
But when you have these rounds of violence every few years, so, you know, you kind of fall into the cycle. You know that this is just the way it is. You hit them, they hit you, you try to hit them a little harder and deter them and weaken them a bit to kind of push off for as long as possible the next round. But what's happening now in cities like Lod, Akko, Umm al-Fahm up north, even Yafo to an extent, the tension that is simmering and blowing up between Jews and Arabs in these mixed cities, which used to be, I don't want to say beacons of coexistence, because, you know, that might be pushing it a bit, but definitely examples of what coexistence could look like between Jews and Arabs inside Israel, is now exploding in our faces. And this is a problem that really is going to have to be dealt with and is setting us back. Remember, in 2000 was when the October riots happened up north, and I think it was just over a dozen Israeli Arabs who were shot and killed by police, and there was then a commission called the Or Commission. But that really caused a major damage to Jewish Arab ties here in Israel. It took a long time to get to where we are today. We're even, you know, talking about Abbas Mansour joining a government. But now with these riots that are going on, again, we're going to have to go through this rehabilitation or repair process.
Yeah, I mean, I find this even more distressing than the rockets from Gaza, because as you said, we go through these rounds and they repeat themselves, and they're serious and they're bad, but we kind of more or less know how they usually go.
Right.
But the fact that this has turned into rioting, you know, in the mixed Jewish Arab cities across Israel, or also just in the Negev, there's been a lot of cases of Bedouins setting up these sort of roadblocks to try to attack Jews who are driving by on the highways. In Lod, the only word I could use to describe what's happening in Lod is a pogrom. I mean, they're burning down synagogues and destroying Torahs in the synagogues. It's awful. And it came at a time where we felt like there was going to be this sort of great flourishing of coexistence between Jews and Arabs. And, you know, not everyone, but some on the right were talking about greater cooperation with Arabs. Netanyahu said he was going to appoint a minister to deal with issues in the Arab sector. And that to some extent was a cynical election ploy, but I don't think Netanyahu...
Netanyahu doesn't do cynical election ploys, Lahav. Come on.
But the thing is that Netanyahu wouldn't have done it if there wasn't acceptance in his base, I think. Right?
Because things have changed. I think you're right. Things have changed, and there was a feeling that things could change. And this will definitely potentially set that back. I think Abbas Mansour had an opportunity. Herb Kanan, our longtime analyst, was writing about this week, that Abbas Mansour, this is your moment. Step up, right? Show the Arabs in Israel, the Palestinians, that there's a different way to work with the Jews. But he's been quite silent, right? And that's unfortunate.
Well,
I think he had an opportunity to an extent.
To give Mansour Abbas some credit, he did make a statement against violence. But that was it. He made a statement against violence. He's not really coming out in full force. You know, he made a big gamble when he came out in favor of cooperating with, you know, the Zionists, quote unquote, on civic issues.
Right.
But now, so we know that he can do more than release a statement.
We're going to have a conversation with Anna Ehrenheim, Jerusalem Post military correspondent, to go dive a bit deeper into Gaza intelligence, what Israel's been attacking, how it's been operating, and what the longer terms might look like for this operation. But Lahav, at the end of this, after that conversation, we're going to talk to Nellie Bowles, right? Tell us just a bit about her, right? There's Shavuot, that's Sunday night. Can't forget, big Jewish holiday. That commemorating, marking when the Jews who left the Israelites, left Mitzrayim, left Egypt, and 50 days later received the Ten Commandments. So who's Nellie? Tell us who she is.
Well, so first of all, on Shavuot, right, we read the book of Ruth. Ruth was the great-grandmother of King David, and she converted to Judaism. And, the main celebration of Shavuot is about getting the Torah, but I think we also... sort of honor people who converted to Judaism in a way on Shavuot as well. And that was why I wanted to invite Nellie Bowles onto our podcast. I was very excited to have her. She has been writing a newsletter called Chosen by Choice, and it is about the process she's been undergoing to convert to Judaism. Nellie is also the partner of Barry Weiss, the former New York Times and Wall Street Journal writer who wrote the book How to Fight Anti-Semitism. I'm sure many of you know her. But Nellie herself, I think, has written very beautifully about Judaism, about what it means to her, about what Jewish community means to her. And so she will be talking to us about that.
And you'll notice, listeners, that conversation, unfortunately, was abruptly cut short with a siren. And we'll hear in real time how Lahav in Tel Aviv, very coolly, I must say, Lahav, managed that situation. So, to your credit, you were cool and you knew what to do. So, a lesson in taking things seriously as well. But let's begin. So, So, Annie, give us the latest. We're talking now. It's Wednesday morning. Israel has been after 48 hours of constant barrages and rocket fire, striking near Jerusalem, striking in Tel Aviv, striking near where you live in Rishon, Chulon, all over the country. Lots of rockets, lots of airstrikes. But to me, it seems that maybe Israel was caught a bit off guard by this escalation, as if it didn't see it coming. What do you think about that?
I think to say that that Israel was caught off guard is, I think surprising in a way, because you would think that a military which prides itself on its intelligence gathering would understand the situation on the ground in both the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and in Gaza, and also understand and know the firepower that Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, what they have. The fact that we have over 1,000 rockets and mortars fired in less than 36 hours is absolutely crazy, and something that we haven't seen in past conflicts. And it's probably going to continue for the next couple of days. And, you know, those thousands are going to the numbers are going to keep going up.
But do you really feel like they weren't prepared? Because I don't know. To me, it's like for weeks now, we've been talking about how this Ramadan has become more violent and all of these sort of special dates, you know, Layl al-Qadr, Jerusalem Day, tonight is Eid al-Fitr, Friday is Nakba Day. Like, we've known for a while that these were going to be times of violence. You think they're just caught off guard by how violent it was?
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, the military was supposed to kick off a large drill the day that all this violence started. What also surprises me is how the police were also caught off guard. Also, it's what's happening in Lod, how those two, the violence in the Arab-Israeli communities, compounded by the rocket attacks that we're having on Israel, both of that together just shows that the two defense establishment bodies, the police and the military, which is supposed to protect the Israeli population, were just not ready. Whether it be ready in terms of the intensity or ready in terms of whatever, they were not ready.
But it's interesting
because I think it was surprising.
Like what Lahab was just saying, you know, Israel kind of knew and saw this coming. We knew there was escalation. We knew of all the different hot points or tension points that were along the way here. We know that Al-Aqsa is always this kind of attraction for violence, right? And that happened. And Kohavi, who's the chief of staff, is a well-experienced, war-torn general, I guess, to some extent, right? Was commander of the Gaza division. He knows Gaza. But even when it started and they fired rockets at Jerusalem on Jerusalem Day, so on at the capital of a country, on that capital, on that country's national holiday, we were slow to retaliate. It seemed like we were hesitating a bit.
I mean, I don't know if it was hesitation. It was probably waiting around, you know, twiddling their thumbs until something did happen, and that's when we retaliate.
Well, and there's also the, you know, decisions have to be made on the political level, right? Like Netanyahu and Gantz, and it might not be Kohavi, it might be them. At this point, I don't know.
And another point, which I think is interesting, is we've seen the Hamas and Islamic Jihad, right? So we've seen them before fire rockets towards Tel Aviv. They did that back in 2014.
They did it in May 2019.
And in May 2019 as well, right? So we know for years that they've had this capability.
It was great fun.
No, I'm sure. But they've also been rolling out new rockets. They've showed an intensity and a rapid rate of fire power that we haven't necessarily seen in the past. At some point, even, I don't know if, you know, it depends who you ask, but they claim that they've overwhelmed Iron Dome, especially in Ashkelon. The IDF is saying that there was some software glitch or malfunction that allowed for those rockets to penetrate the Iron Dome defense system. But what are you seeing as someone who's kind of followed these rocket attacks and violence cycles over years, in terms of Hamas and Islamic Jihad capabilities? Is there some improvement that we're noticing this time?
I mean, these groups are not sitting by and watching Netflix when there's peace and quiet. These are groups.
Maybe they should. Maybe that's the solution.
They should.
Maybe they should watch
Fauda. maybe not Fauda. Maybe a comedy show would be more appropriate. But
Stiesel.
Sure. Or Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Who knows? But these guys are working on their missile technology all the time. They're firing rockets into the sea all the time. And you know what? I was actually going back over my old work, and former Defense Minister Lieberman actually spoke about how Hamas has ballistic missiles, something that, you know, a lot of people were saying, he's just talking gibberish and what have you. But, you know, maybe they do have that capability, a capability that is quite dangerous. And they also, when they're trying to get past the Iron Dome, they're doing so by firing, you know, hundreds of missiles and rockets at one time, because the Iron Dome can't get every single rocket. And we saw that last night.
You know, I was thinking last night that it just the sheer amount that they're shooting, you know, all in sort of one salvo, it could be an attempt to overwhelm the Iron Dome. Is there a danger of that?
I think that there's a danger in everything, really. But what we really have to do is make sure that when a siren goes off, no matter what, we find shelter.
Well, that's the active defense and passive defense. You know, right. Annie, another thing that we've seen in this operation, which, by the way, I mean, can't they do something about these names? What is Guardian of the Wall? Right. Well, what is that? Star Lord, is that who the Guardians of the Wall wants to be?
Guardians of the Wall is like Game of Thrones, right? There's the Night's Watch. That's their whole job, to guard the wall from the White Walkers. But it's just, you know, anyone who's nerdy enough to know about that.
Yeah, so I never watched Game of Thrones, but someone's got to do something about these names, because it's like, you know, they got to figure something out to come up with catchier, snappier names. But what we have seen is that in this operation, Guardians of the Wall, we've seen some impressive intelligence operations, right? They've put an emphasis in the IDF this time on targeted killings. They've taken out some senior Hamas and Islamic Jihad operatives, at least according to Israel. These guys are senior, like head of Gaza, the Gaza Brigade, the Rafiah Brigade, the anti-tank missile unit, the military intelligence, things like that, which shows a serious intelligence penetration. So I'm curious, you know, and you've written a lot about how the target bank works and how they have this, you know, what they call in Hebrew Merkaz Eish, or center, fire center, where they gather intelligence and they quickly close all the circuitry and pass it on to whichever aircraft or platform can attack. So how deep is the intelligence penetration in Gaza for Israel? Is it hard to get this information? Like, do we also know what Ismail, you know, we were talking about Netflix, do we know what Ismail Haniyeh watches on Netflix? Like, how deep does it actually go in Gaza?
Well, I think you can look at a report. I don't remember from which paper this came from, but the report that Israel gave to the Americans, the number of Qasem Soleimani. If we were able to penetrate into that and to get his number and to know where he was, I mean, it's much easier to get the intelligence on Hamas leaders and Qasem Soleimani. Qasem Soleimani was a military genius, and he was responsible for everything that we see in Syria. So to get, you know, to crack the Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza, I'm sure we've done that a long time ago.
Interesting.
So where do you think we're going from here? Netanyahu talked about a long campaign. Do we have any way of knowing at this point if it's going to be an air campaign, if they're going to start calling up reserves?
I think we have to wait and see. I don't think it's going to be a matter of a few days. It could be a few weeks. If they do call up the reserves and we have a ground operation, then maybe even longer. This is something that could have been prevented, should have been prevented, should have been stopped. You know, people, you know, said when with the Mount Meron tragedy that was something that could have been prevented, but nobody's talking about Meron anymore. But just like Meron, what we're seeing now, it's the same thing. But neither side wants to come to the table and talk and negotiate and reach a ceasefire. The IDF is very clear that they want to hit Hamas hard. Hamas is very clear that they want to continue hitting in retaliation for the Israeli strike. So this tit for tat is going to go on until somebody will be the responsible adult in the room and come to the table and sit down and be, okay, khalas, we need to stop this.
Okay. On that note, Annie, we will hope that at some point soon, sooner rather than later, this does end. Important just to point out that we're speaking on Wednesday. The podcast will be coming out at the end of the week. By then, this could all be over, or we could be watching tanks start to roll into the Gaza Strip. We don't know. Hopefully by then, there will be an end to this conflict, for now at least. Thanks, Annie.
Thank you.
So now for the tweet of the week. I have the traditional Jewish way of handling difficult events and trauma, which is, I think, with humor. And this sort of new military operation Israel has embarked on is no different. In every round of fighting with Hamas in Gaza, we have new internet memes, videos, jokes. So I don't just have one tweet of the week. We're here to talk about a bunch of those. Right. One of my favorites from the last few days, there's been video going around of people filming the Iron Dome interceptions in the sky in Tel Aviv, and you see these sort of dozens of sparks in the sky. And somebody set it to the music, the theme music from Star Wars, so it kind of looks like there's a space battle going on in Tel Aviv. So I found that one very amusing. What have you?
That's a great one. I also saw someone put Star Wars 10, right? Because the last movie was number 9, so now this is this is number 10. There was one that I enjoyed. You know, Israel has obviously been rocking it with the vaccinations. Maybe rocking, not the best word, but has been doing a very good job getting over almost 5.5 million people, I think, vaccinated. So I saw one that was at the entrance to one of these bomb shelter or safe rooms where people are saying, are you vaccinated? Do you have your green pass? Right? Because only people with green passes can come in.
Yeah, I thought that was really funny. One of my favorites of all time in this genre is, I believe it was in 2014, but it could have been 2012, I'm not sure. When Hamas, they released a song that the lyrics mean like attack, commit terrorist attacks. It was called Tkof Tivatzea Piguim, but it was in the most like awkward, weird sounding Hebrew. And Israelis just turned it into this huge joke. Israelis just like loved this song, and it became like the hit of the summer. And it was just very funny.
You know, I think that the humor side of it all, right, is in one thing that's always impressed me in almost 30 years living here is really the resilience of Israelis. Since inception in 1948, from immediately in upon inception, Israel has been engaged in conflict and attempts to destroy it by its Arab neighbors, by the different terrorist organizations that now surround it. And it's had to cope with that, right? So obviously it's had to fight back, it's had to defend itself, it's had to go on the offensive at times, but it's also had to find a way to manage it on an emotional, psychological level, right? And I think that that's where some of this humor comes from, is, you know, at the same time that, yes, it's terrible that these rockets are falling and people are getting scarred emotionally and getting hurt physically, obviously, and sadly people are even dying. There's a lot of Israelis are doing what they can, and the way to cope with that is through humor and sending out a meme and a funny tweet.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I'll just read a couple of other things just so that we could end on that humorous note. Is that someone named Amir Shankman wrote on Facebook, could we do this war on Zoom? And then another one is, yeah, there's a lot of like foreign workers who live, like migrant workers who live in South Tel Aviv. So there was one that said that, you know, there was a siren in South Tel Aviv. So the president of Sudan said that we will respond to any harm to our own citizens. I thought it was also pretty funny because, you know.
And by the way, one that I've seen a lot of people are talking about how they miss 2020, right? Which is, you know, the year of Corona, but now it's been going on in 2021 so far. It hasn't been that good.
All right, so next we have our interview with Nellie Bowles, the writer of Chosen by Choice, a newsletter about converting to Judaism. And we brought her on in honor of Shavuot, when we honor people who converted to Judaism in the vein of the Book of Ruth. And you will hear at the end the very abrupt finish to this interview when the air raid sirens went off in Tel Aviv. All right, we're here with Nellie Bowles, the writer of the newsletter Chosen by Choice, about her experience converting to Judaism. It's a weekly newsletter that I've been enjoying very much. And since on Shavuot, we talk a lot about Ruth converting to Judaism, I thought she would be someone interesting to speak to this week. Nellie, thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. It is a total honor to be chatting with you guys.
So what inspired you to start a newsletter about your journey to Judaism?
Yeah, I mean, I started converting maybe 2 years ago now, and I noticed that, I was inspired by a bunch of things, but first I noticed that there wasn't a whole lot of content and writing about the convert experience. And there was this kind of sense that it was something not to talk about. And it's considered rude to ask a convert about their conversion experience or to ask them when they converted or anything like that. And that was taught to most young American Jews as a way of being polite. And so there's not a whole lot of open conversation about people who are converting to Judaism or among converts talking about it. So I was inspired to start writing about my experience and to try to fill that void a little bit with my own experience of it, and then also to try to bring in other voices of other people who are converting or have converted, and why they did that, and their essays too. And and then on a personal level, why I started converting is I fell in love with a Jewish person for whom Judaism was really important. And just over the years of being together, it started to become important to me.
As someone who grew up observant and as a member of the tribe and following all these laws, and when you grow up observant, there's all these laws, the halacha, the Jewish laws of what you cannot do. Now, there's a lot you can do, and there's a lot of beauty that comes with religion. But as someone who, as a child, definitely, so as a teenager, you look at what's going on and you're always taken aback by what you're not allowed to do. You can't do this on Shabbat. You can't do this on the holiday. You can't eat this food. You can't eat that food. And then you meet someone who's converting, who's saying, no, I want to take upon myself restrictions. And I, for one, have just always been fascinated by that. So the question that I'd like to ask, and you mentioned earlier how people are hesitant or wary to begin these conversations and talk about this as if it's almost taboo, and you got to be careful because it's a sensitive issue within the community. But why would someone want to do that? I've always been fascinated. Why would someone want to take on these restrictions?
It's a really, really good question. And I love how you phrased it too, about taking on restrictions. I think on an emotional level, I have found that taking on some of the rules and taking on some of the restrictions and the rituals it's cliche, but it's been very freeing. Like taking on the ritual of Shabbat, I find to have given me a lot and to have made my life better. And I think, again, totally cliche, but total freedom doesn't make people all that happy. And total optionality doesn't make people all that happy. So the kind of human emotional reason why religion and religious rules and religious traditions and practices click and why they make sense is because our nature doesn't want total freedom. And in terms of the other aspect of that question, which is the idea of converting or joining a tribe that's been persecuted and a tribe that has been oppressed, that's a really complicated, ongoing question for any convert. I mean, it's kind of the fundamental one of like, if shit hits the fan, will you stand with the Jewish people? And I think part of the wariness around converts sometimes is the wariness that maybe they won't.
On that point, if I may, shit hits the fan with the Jewish people all the time. We're speaking as rockets are flying into Israel from the Gaza Strip, right? We're speaking just a few days before the Shavuot holiday. There's always something going on, right? There's always in Israel under attack, a Jewish people under attack, right? There's anti-Semitism. There's BDS. It's joining a people that you know are going to be a target for something.
And even closer to home, you said you've been converting for 2 years. So, I mean, it was just 2.5 years ago when there was the shooting at the Pittsburgh synagogue, which your partner, Barry Weiss, has written so eloquently about. And it was the synagogue she attended in her childhood. So I imagine you had a very acute sense of that.
Yeah. Going from a person who's in the kind of dominant culture to a person who's joining a oppressed group is really complicated and really interesting and is real. I mean, I guess the question then is still just sort of why, right? I think for me, the answer is that what Judaism is bringing to my life and the Jewish world that I see, it's worth it.
So tell us a bit about that, if you don't mind. What is it bringing to your life? What is the beauty that you're finding? You write about, I've read some of your posts about Shabbat, which are very eloquent and beautiful and moving, of, you know, keeping a little portable Torah in your brain and memorizing more and singing, being able to sing from memory, things like that. Like, what is it that grabs you here?
I think at the start, it was seeing families, it was seeing sort of Jewish community, and seeing how the religion was so woven into the home and so woven around the dinner table and around parents and children. And it was just really beautiful, really different from anything I had seen. And then as I started just living Jewishly by proxy, just by being with a Jewish person, which some 70% of Reform, of non-Orthodox Jews marry non-Jews. So that's a very common experience for the non-Orthodox Jews in America, of being with a Gentile like myself. But I think just living Jewishly really clicked for me. Shabbat, obviously, that was the first part. And in the kind of dumb sense of, oh, a digital detox, which, yeah, was great. And putting my phone away for 25 hours was really nice, but also just elevating it beyond that and elevating it to say for 25 hours of every week, I'm going to be reading and thinking and trying to be a better person this week and trying to be around my family. That really clicked for me. And I started doing that before I even was thinking I would convert. But I think also part of it is like developing a sense of humility around how much I can solve and come up with in one human lifetime. Like, a lot of the rituals make sense to me because it's like I can't invent a better ritual to initiate a 13-year-old into adulthood than Judaism has invented. I can't invent a better set of rituals around death than Judaism has invented. I can't come up with a better set in my mind. And so part of it is like the humility of being like, you know what, there's a really good program here and this really works and it's worked for a long time and I have grown to love it. And then
there's a siren going off in Tel Aviv. I gotta run. I'll call you guys back.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Oh my God. I'm sorry. Bye.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.